are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 11th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Eric Levitz, staff writer, New York Magazine, answering the question, when will the mainstream media understand Republicans are authoritarian con men? Meanwhile, the Trump EPA to weaken the clean water protections you thought we would enjoy. Covert foreign agent Maria Butina cops a plea, supposedly cooperating. And tech bro Reid Hoffman to start a Koch brothers style voter database. We're going to get rid of that two-party system, folks. It's just going to be two-billionaire system. Trump administration shielding Wells Fargo's college student gouging. And the farm bill looks close to passage. The Democratic win in the midterms has saved SNAP access for millions of Americans. Meanwhile, Kavanaugh and Roberts pass on the question of Planned Parenthood funding in a classic keep your powder dry scenario. Across the Atlantic, Brexit is FUBAR, and I don't have a clue as to what's going on. I'm going to find out what the hell is going on over there. I have no idea. Can't follow it.
One detail is Theresa May got locked in a car and someone picked up a mace.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds...
He did do that. There's a special mace because they do Harry Potter government over there. And somebody picked it up and he got in trouble.
Meanwhile, thousands of Florida absentee ballots uncounted because of that bombing scare before the election. And folks, I hope you... your windows and doors are locked. Half the troops are leaving the border. Now we're like naked in the face of the caravan. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is a famous Tuesday version of the Majority Report. Of course, we do a version every day. And we do so because our members support this program. You can be one of those people. What do you get? You get your podcast commercial free. You get, we have three ads today. We've got Quip. I mean, I love these brands. Quip, Liquid IV, and Third Love. But you get your podcast commercial free. You also get extra content virtually every day. And then you also get our undying gratitude. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, we are now, not only are we in double digits for the tickets for the PodFest in Brooklyn on January 13th at 2:30 p.m., but we are under... way under one sixth. All right, I don't know.
Getting some crooked fractions.
Hurry. Let's put it this way: you got probably, I would guess, at the rate that we've been going, less than a week.
Under 15%. Competition would start kicking in.
Competition has kicked in, folks, and now it's. If you are even contemplating it, get your tickets now. All right. I want to start with this, but before I do, When you think of the perfect gift, you probably don't think of an electric toothbrush. Now, you've heard me say multiple times over the past couple of years that I have thought about that. My sister, I got one of these, and my dad. But the Quip electric toothbrush is one of the most gift-guided gifts of the season. Here's why. It's perfect for everyone with a mouth, and it's something they'll use twice a day. Frankly, you're not going to hurt yourself to use it three times a day. Plus, it has a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors and unmounts to slide over the bristles so you can travel with it. Quip makes holiday travels clean and easy. And with sensitive sonic vibrations, it's gentle enough for sensitive gums. Better yet, the built-in timer pulses to remind you when to switch sides. For me, my favorite thing about the Quip is that not only does it make it easy to use your electric toothbrush, it is not this big, bulky thing that sits on your very small sink counter, right? You have a small sink, right?
I do. I have a very small sink.
You do.
Certainly.
Brendan, anybody who lives in an apartment understands that, like, you can't, this is not one of those things where you have, like, two sinks and, you know, you have this huge, like, territory to lay your stuff out. The Quip fits practically in one of those your normal toothbrush holders.
Yeah, it's a normal size as a toothbrush.
And then you can travel with it. And the whole point about having an electric toothbrush is you've got to use it. And then also, don't forget, you got to angle, come down from the gums, brush away. I'm not even going to go into the periodontal work that I've had and what they found up there when they do that the deep cleaning. So, please. But the Quip is a fantastic toothbrush. Almost everyone I know now has a Quip. I am not being facetious about that. Both my sisters, family, friends.
It's the longest I've used an electric toothbrush because of the replacement heads.
Boom. What did I tell you at the beginning of this? It's the most important thing about an electric toothbrush is that you use it. And that's why I love Quip and why they've had over 5,000 verified five-star reviews. It looks like a big ticket tech gift with a stocking stuffer price, just at starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. But you don't have to tell your giftee that. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. Got to change that brush head every 3 months. This makes you do it and inexpensively. Also, staying properly hydrated, particularly this time of year. You're traveling. Maybe you're drinking a lot. Maybe you got a cold. Thankfully, Liquid IV provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. When we get the boxes in here of Liquid IV, they last about 3 days. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody, but because you're all culprits. You all know who you are. It has 110% daily value of vitamin C, B12, and non-GMO clean ingredients. It's a healthy alternative to traditional sports drinks, and it delivers hydration to the bloodstream faster and more efficiently than water alone. It's because of the vitamins and minerals, folks. I'm no scientist, but that's what I understand. 5 essential vitamins. It also has more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. I love Liquid IV. I know you will, too. Right now, my listeners get 20% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. So go to liquid-iv.com. That's liquid-iv.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration. liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. And lastly, support for today's show comes from Third Love. What they do is they use millions of real women's measurements. Third Love designs its bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and an incredible feel. Here's what you do. You answer a few simple questions from Third Love's Fit Finder quiz to find your perfect fit. I have seen it, actually. There's a whole diagram about your breast size or where your breasts go in different directions.
It's some complicated physics.
I understand. Third Love offers double the number of sizes that most brands offer. Cups A through H, bands up to 48, and with lightweight memory foam cups, straps that won't slip, and tagless labels, you want to wear these soft, breathable bras and underwear every day, especially the new cotton t-shirt bras and underwear. Thanks to a 100% fit guarantee, returns and exchanges are free and easy. I'm going to be honest with you. I have not tried these bras. I do not wear bras. I have never worn a bra. I don't anticipate wearing one in the future. However, good friend has told me that the things she likes about it, they don't have a zillion options. So it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. They tell me they usually have to return most bras they order online, even though they're in the proper size, because bras, you know, like anything else, the sizing sometimes can be off. She ordered two bras. They both fit. She said that almost never happens. They're super comfortable for everyday use, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. So you don't feel basic, but you do feel comfortable. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. Right now, they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. So Paul Ryan is exiting stage, probably, I don't know, lobby. He's heading to, I mean, I imagine that's what he's going to be doing. And he is, you know, I have not seen all the stories that are attempting to salvage his legacy quite yet. His press team is probably on it, and they're going to get out there soon. We'll start to see these long lead articles that come out.
Rich Lowry, maybe?
Yeah, I would imagine at the beginning in January, maybe in the next couple of days, we're going to start seeing magazine pieces about how he was a stalwart. He represented real Republican values. Maybe someday the real Republican Party will come back to him. All of this BS that all these, you know, that he deep down was a never Trumper, but he put the party above his own personal preference. I mean, who knows what kind of sanctimonious crap we're going to hear about this guy. But then there are people who also feel compelled to salvage their legacy, or at least their legacy and how it's wrapped up with Paul Ryan's. Now, let me say this straight up. I think Ezra Klein is a smart guy. And there are pieces that he's written that I've been very impressed with. The one that he just did about YouTubers and about that type of media, I thought was quite good. And there's been stuff over the years that I think I've found that he's done well. But one of the tendencies that he's had that I have witnessed over really, I probably close to my entire professional career, from back when he was, I think, at the American Prospect. And is a tendency that is, and I think, you know, when we talk to Eric Levitz about this, we're going to see it across the board, that is to want to be considered to be a serious thinker, and therefore suspending his disbelief in realms of politics that are about politics. I understand and I appreciate policy analysis, but policy is irrelevant if the policy is being promoted as a fig leaf for something else, or if the policy is being offered in something with less than good faith. There has been so many instances of Paul Ryan. I mean, just off the top of my head, I'm thinking about like his plan for Medicare. And his plan for Medicare was to totally privatize it. But the argument was, well, we're still calling it Medicare. So it's not fundamentally changing Medicare. It's Medicare. But the whole point of Medicare is not the name. The whole point of Medicare is that it is a government-run sponsored health insurance program. It's not a voucher system. Public school is not taxes taken, the money put into a fund denoted public education, and then handed out to private schools. That's not public school. That's private school funded by the public. That's just one example that comes to my mind, but that is the most classic illustration of Paul Ryan's BS. So Ezra Klein has written a piece at Vox entitled Paul Ryan's Long Con. And in it, he spends the first couple of pages saying, Paul Ryan's reputation was built on the back of his budgets. Draconian documents that gutted social spending, privatized Medicare, and showed the Republican Party had embraced the kinds of hard fiscal choices that George Bush had sloughed off. And Ryan represented himself or presented himself as the wonkish apostle of the new GOP, rolling up his sleeves and running through the charts, graphs, and tables that made his case. And this is about how Ezra Klein says that Paul Ryan never did what he said he was going to do, which was to cut deficits. In fact, deficits grew at a time when we were expanding our economy and they should have shrunk. And you should know, for the sake of this, that I think Ezra Klein has been fairly consistent in not caring that much about deficits in specific, you know, per se. Certainly, I don't. But Paul Ryan claimed to. Now, in the entire 15 years I've been doing this, starting with George Bush cutting Social Security, there has been near unanimity on the left of understanding that this whole deficit thing was largely about a fig leaf to cut things like Social Security and Medicare so that rich people could have more taxes and probably to put most Americans in a weaker position when it comes to negotiating with corporations who might hire them. Because if you don't have health insurance, if you don't feel like you have a safety net, right, you are in a weakened power dynamic with anybody you might negotiate with. And Al Gore knew this. That's why he was calling for the lockbox, that thing that he kept getting made fun of. And the lockbox was pretty necessary when George Bush said, well, all there is just an IOUs here. There's no money here. Just IOUs, Treasury. Anyways. So Ryan wrote in the book Young Guns, I admit in recent years, Republicans have abandoned these principles of fiscal conservatism. We've lost the true path and suffered electoral defeats, but we've not returned from this experience empty handed. For this, Ryan was feted in Washington society. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget gave him a Fiske Award for budget bravery. He was a member of the Simpson-Bowles Commission. He became Mitt Romney's vice president. I was among the reporters who took Ryan's reboot seriously. To move us to surpluses, I wrote of his 2010 proposal, Ryan's budget proposes reforms that are nothing short of violent. Medicare is privatized. Seniors get a voucher to buy private insurance, and the voucher growth is far slower than expected growth of healthcare costs. Medicaid is also privatized. The employer tax exclusion is fully eliminated, replaced by tax credit that grows more slowly than medical costs. I didn't agree with Ryan's policies, but at least he was making the trade-offs of his vision clear. But to critics like New York Times' Paul Krugman, Ryan was an obvious con man, weaponizing the deficit to hamstring Obama's presidency, weaken the recovery, and snooker Beltway centrists, eager to champion a reasonable-seeming Republican. Now, this is an interesting rhetorical trick that Ezra Klein performs here, and I don't know if he's aware of it. The way that he refers to himself is, I was one of the reporters who took Ryan's reboot seriously. The way that he refers to Paul Krugman as a critic He doesn't even say Krugman's name first. He doesn't say Paul Krugman. The Nobel Prize-winning economist was critical of Paul Ryan. He just says to his critics, like Paul Krugman. Now, what is the rhetorical trick that's being played here? Imagine if I said to you, instead of I was among the reporters who took Ryan's reboot seriously, it would be among his supporters, among his sycophants, among those who were credulous of Ryan, I took his reboot seriously. I mean, you see the rhetorical trick here. The rhetorical trick is that Paul Krugman was inclined to be critical of anyone, and therefore his analysis was just coincidentally right. Now, I may be overstating it a little bit to show this rhetorical trick, but that's the rhetorical trick that's being played here. And then Ezra goes on to say, in his budgets for all the hard choices didn't actually add up. They included massive tax cuts with underestimated costs and unspecified finding, which is what led Krugman to call him a charlatan back in 2010. Ryan had waved this away as nitpicking. Well, but his critics predicted he would lose his appetite for hard choices the moment his party returned to power. He hasn't changed. He has merely rebranded. The numbers proved them right. Ryan was elected Speaker of the House on October 29th, 2015. Over the next 3 years, annual deficits increased by almost 80%. Now, and then he goes on to say to Ryan's supporters, this is unfair. Being Speaker of the House, the most Faustian job in history. But then Ezra says, I think that's too kind. As Speaker, Ryan had tremendous power. He could have done this. He could have brought immigration's compromises to the floor, but he had PAYGO. But he didn't put PAYGO down for tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera. We are the choices we make, and Ryan made his. I took Ryan seriously when he said he was concerned about deficits. I covered the arguments Ryan made. The policies he crafted, I treated them like as he offered a guide to how Republicans would govern. I listened to when Ryan said things like, in Europe, generations of welfare-dependent citizens are hurling Molotov cocktails because their governments can no longer fund their entitlement programs. We can't let that happen here. Now, here's the problem. This story about why Paul Ryan was a con man is interesting, but it's not a huge newsflash because Paul Krugman was saying this 8 years ago. The interesting story is, why did you take Ryan seriously when he said he was? What is the failure of Ezra Klein, and not just Ezra Klein, but all the other centrist reporters? And I don't know what that means. I don't know what a centrist reporter means.
Credulous
reporters. Why were you so credulous when Paul Krugman wasn't? That's the only interesting story here. It's not that Paul Ryan's a con man, because Paul Krugman and others told us that 8 years ago. The interesting story is, why do you, who was at the time one of the premier Washington Post policy analysis people, why were you so credulous? You've told us the numbers didn't add up. And there were other people who knew he was a con man and he wasn't serious. What made you take him so seriously? There is no such thing as policy in a vacuum, particularly when it comes to politicians. Right? Like, I don't even think there's policy in a vacuum at a think tank. But when you're talking about a politician, why is it that the media will be credulous, so credulous, with reams and reams of evidence to the contrary when it comes to the Iraq war, when it comes to the notion of deficits? I've said on this program many times before that the reason why the press, early on was not capable of dealing with the lies that were coming from Donald Trump was because they had not exercised that muscle that made them assess the validity of a claim when it came to Republicans in at least a decade or two. And the chickens have come home to roost. And the bottom line is, we still see it. We still see it. It's irrelevant that you call Paul Ryan a con man now. It's irrelevant because he's leaving office. The time to call a con man is when he's in the midst of conning people. When you say in retrospect he's a con man, that story is boring. The interesting story is, why did the marks, what was it about the marks who are still amongst us, who are still providing us an assessment as to whether we can trust certain politicians, why did they get conned? And that's not in this story. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Eric Levitz about the conning that continues to go on. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program New York Magazine staff writer Eric Levitz. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, you had a piece just a couple of days ago, I guess. The GOP is making its contempt for democracy clear. Will the mainstream media... I think we all know the answer to this, but let's talk about specifically what you're talking about, because I just went through my diatribe of, and you know, Ezra Klein more or less, I think, entered into the sort of center left world of punditry and reporting. He's a reporter. I am not really in any way, but around the same time. Back in the early aughts, and he wrote a piece about, you know, as you know, Paul Ryan being a con man. And for me, it's a lot less interesting that Paul Ryan's a con man. In the piece himself, he said that we got fair warning from a New York Times columnist about this, who was fairly prominent at the time, that Paul Ryan was a con man. Why this happens? And you've written a piece about the failure of the mainstream media to notice the Republican Party's repeated examples of not giving a shit about democracy. Just lay out those examples.
Sure. So the jumping off point for the piece was the events in North Carolina's now ninth House district, where, you know, in North Carolina, the Republican Party has pushed voter ID laws very strongly, had really sounded the alarm about the threat that voter fraud poses to American elections, and they were obviously not alone in doing that. The GOP, since at least the second Bush administration when they launched a five-year Justice Department investigation into voter fraud and ultimately produced no evidence, but nevertheless persisted in pushing the idea that restrictions on voting were desperately required to avert this phantom threat, has really been committed to the idea that, look, even if there's like a 1% chance that our elections are going to be tainted by fake votes, then or people voting who aren't allowed to vote, perhaps because they're African American and were subjected to abusive policing and then got into the criminal justice system and then we decided to disenfranchise them for that. But that aside, that this is such a terrible thing that it's, you know, if we need to disenfranchise poor voters who don't have driver's licenses, that's just the price that we need to pay. If we need to prosecute immigrants who are here legally but aren't yet qualified to vote and they didn't quite realize that and they cast a ballot that they shouldn't have, we need to put them in prison for 8 years, as prosecutors have been doing, because it's just the integrity of our elections is just that darn important. And then we have in North Carolina's 9th House District a Republican candidate hiring a convicted fraudster to essentially run a completely fraudulent absentee ballot operation where he hired people to go around this county, Bladen County, North Carolina, and collect absentee ballots, bring them to him, and the ones that he liked, he would file. The ones that he didn't, he would destroy.
Now, Eric, hold on. To be fair, yeah. Who better to pick up fraudulent ballots than a fraudster?
No, I mean, I don't fault the hiring decisions that were made, just the general ethical orientation of the operation.
Right.
So this happens. There's overwhelming evidence, not just evidence that this scheme possibly cost the Democrat the general election, but that actually the incumbent Republican congressman was a victim of this same scheme in the Republican primary and probably lost his seat to it. So a Republican was victimized by this fraud. But the overall upshot of everything was that a Republican was going to hold that House seat in a swing district. And so initially, the North Carolina GOP, the party that was all about protecting the integrity of our elections, decided that, you know what, actually, well, preventing voter fraud is on the one hand worth disenfranchising black voters to prevent ensuring that a House election isn't stolen amidst overwhelming evidence is not worth waiting a couple of weeks to finish the investigation. They called for the Board of Elections to immediately certify the results. They sent out donor calls that tried to raise money off the idea that Democrats were illegitimately trying to steal the election by insisting on an investigation into the evidence of election fraud. They also, alternatively, some others began using it as an excuse to push for even stricter, less access to the ballot to cut down on mail-in voting because, look, see, it's such a huge liability in our system. Meanwhile, in the legislature, North Carolina Republicans put forward a bill that totally neutral, fair rule that's just stipulated that the party in the state that has the second most registered members, that party should control all of the county election boards in even-numbered years, and then the party with the most members should control it in odd-numbered years, and then this way it's split and it's fair, which in North Carolina, Republicans have the second most number of members and apparently anticipate that they aren't going to grow their party. And so are legislating that in every year where there's an election, all of the election boards need to be controlled by us, which, you know, right now those election boards are the one thing standing between them and stealing this House race. So since I wrote the piece, North Carolina Republicans have realized that their situation is untenable and have started to gesture towards being possibly open to a makeup election. Nonetheless, that's what they've been doing. And so my argument is, like, if you have something this blatant here, up to this point, the mainstream media, whenever covering this issue, has always made a point of, you know, acting as though we need to, you know, give the benefit of the doubt
right.
that Republicans have this legitimate concern, and every story has at least one quote from them saying this. Now, in the face of a blatant admission of bad faith, you know, this clear, you know, is the Republican, is the mainstream media going to, you know, accept that, no, actually, you know what, there is only one major party that is even facially, even superficially committed to democratic governance, and the other one isn't. And that's like a pretty important thing for the Fourth Estate to be able to communicate to voters. And thus far, that has not been the case, despite not only events in North Carolina, but also the power grab in Wisconsin and Michigan, et cetera.
I want to talk about that in a moment, but just I want to remind people, too, that not only was the Bush administration up to a five-year investigation where they found, literally nothing, there were multiple U.S. attorneys who were fired because they were not coming in with prosecutions. I mean, there was three or four. This became a big scandal that the U.S. attorneys are getting pressured by Karl Rove to bring some of those voter ID cases because they needed some justification to pass this legislation. And, you know, when we talk about what happened in Wisconsin, there's and what's happening in Michigan. I mean, first off, we had years ago indication of this when the in Michigan they passed the city manager rule, right? The failure of democracy, which led you could draw a straight line, frankly, to the poisoning of children in Flint by the water because of that. But just remind us of the New York Times headlines that followed this Wisconsin thing. Yesterday, we played Chuck Todd's interview with Evers, the new governor. I mean, just stunning stuff here.
Yeah, and Todd came after my article and really then validated my pessimism even more than the Times did. But the Times wrote a couple stories about it. One of them infamously, I think they changed the headline, but was headlined Wisconsin Republicans defiantly, quote, stand like bedrock in the face of Democratic winds. My point was that both of their articles on the fight in Wisconsin did not ever, you're covering this dispute, this contest of, you know, who is legitimately has a claim to wield power, the legislature or the executive branch of the government. And in neither of these articles was there even a moment observing that the statewide officers, the incoming governor and attorney general, were elected with the plurality of the vote, were democratically elected, where the state legislature was not, where it's controlled by a party that actually received fewer votes for the assembly and fewer votes statewide than the other party. And yet the party that does not actually have any popular, the branch of government that does not have a popular mandate for its majority is taking powers away from the branch that does. And again, Republicans themselves are not actually all that deceitful about this. The Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss stated explicitly that, he told reporters, well, we would have a majority if it wasn't for Madison and Milwaukee. If you just don't count all the people who live in those cities, then we would have a majority, and so therefore we should govern the state. They're quite explicit that people who don't vote for us really shouldn't have voting rights or say over the government. But that is not emphasized in the mainstream media's reporting on it.
It's not even mentioned. I mean, it's not even mentioned. And I just want to be explicit about this. The Republicans got like 46% of the vote, I think, in Wisconsin, and they have, 54% of the power in the House, or more, actually. It's a veto proof. This one's even more egregious. I'm getting confused with the states. They had under 50% of the vote and something like 65% of the of the power in the state house. That's just
Democrats have 36 of 99 assembly seats.
That's just nuts. It's just nuts. And Chuck Todd just talks like Evers should really be more apologetic to Scott Walker. And maybe Scott Walker will be OK with letting him have some of the authority that Scott Walker had as governor. So, all right. So we have so many examples of this. What's the problem?
I think the problem, I think there are a variety of answers, but I think One basic one is that the mainstream media as it exists today developed in a less polarized political era and around a business model that was about achieving scale by being able to sell newspapers, broadcast news to Democrats and Republicans alike. And doing that requires internalizing an idea of this fundamentally, both presenting a kind of a quality of legitimacy between the two parties, regardless of what they do and do not stand for, and also, sort of implicitly downplaying the stakes of political conflict. That model was deeply problematic from the beginning, but it's, considerably more so when you have one major party that is not committed to the norms of liberal democracy, and yet the media, isn't really adjusting to this. There's so many. It's both, I think they're both business concerns at this point, but also just ideological ones. At this point, the New York Times, I think, from an economic perspective, its subscriber base is overwhelmingly liberals. I don't think it has a real economic incentive to downplay Republican extremism. I think that it's ideological. It's so baked into the norms of that institution that it's kind of reflexive.
Okay, so it's really just muscle memory that they can't. I mean, and we should be clear here, right? Like, this comes from the ownership, and they simply hire people who are inclined to have this disposition, less or maybe not for less for economic. Who knows what's in the heart or minds of another person, but. Their career is built on that same sort of like brand. Like, I take both sides seriously, regardless of any evidence that may be out there to suggest that one of these may not be a good faith actor.
Yeah, I think there is also the need to preserve access to sources in both camps, as far as just the. It was, I guess, a legitimate practical necessity if you're going to do reporting on negotiations in Congress and being able to get, word of where it's heading to the public before it becomes common knowledge, then you do need to have Republican staffers who are willing to talk to you. And if your paper describes in forthright terms what the Republican Party is today, maybe that's not possible. I don't know. I could think of excuses, but regardless, it comes with significant costs.
So, is this the way it's going to be? Like, I mean, I feel like I have been, more or less fighting this fight as consistently as anything else that I've done over the past 15 years. I mean, 14, 15 years ago, we shut down the phone banks at the New York Times Washington Bureau because of Adam Nagorny on the radio. And I don't know what Adam Nagorny is doing these days, but aside from that, it didn't seem to have much impact.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the media environment is really different. You mentioned the Ezra Klein piece. There was also a piece by Matthew Iglesias earlier this week that basically argued that the threat to democracy is actually not populism, but is the GOP establishment and its highly legalistic methods for undermining popular sovereignty, which was sort of an endorsement of arguments made by people like Corey Robin and Jedediah Purdy, people identified with the at least quasi-radical left in the United States. And so I think orthodoxy within the liberal opinion media has really internalized the extremism of the GOP, and that form of media is a lot more prevalent, than when the Majority Report began. And so I think that there's movement in that sense. And I think that it's, you know, there's never going to be an equivalence between the sheer hackishness of each side's infotainment propaganda apparatuses, because there is just a certain amount of intellectual integrity that liberals tend to have more of than conservatives. But I think that Pod Save America is kind of a quasi-Limbaugh for the left, and it is its attitude towards Republicans, you know, even though it is establishment Obama staffers, it's a considerably more more sweeping critique than what we've seen previously. And so there has been movement, I think, in how the average Democratic voter is being told to think about politics by their media. And I think that that's potentially significant.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I would agree with that. And I think your point about that integrity, it also strikes me as the structural disadvantage in this playing field. And maybe it's a disadvantage. It may be for the benefit of all of us, is that compensation in the in this arena for the left and right is different. On the right, it's cash. I mean, it's literally bucket loads of cash. On the left, there is a certain amount of, I'm esteemed by, you know, those in this arena. I feel like that has more cachet on the left than it does on the right. And part of that, I think, it may be because of the sort of like academic roots and value system that seem to be more present on the left.
Yeah, I think that there's obviously there are opportunities to sell out in Democratic politics, but that generally doesn't take the form of jobs in media, more in consulting. Working for the Podesta Group or whatever, but even then I don't think the money is. I mean, did you see like Nick Ayers, like Pence's right-hand man? He's like $54 million is his net worth, apparently, somehow. We're all making a terrible mistake.
Has anybody sort of figure out what that's about? Where's that guy getting that kind of money?
Yeah, I have no idea.
He's like 35, right?
I mean, I think, I don't know, there's got to be bodies buried somewhere, but I don't know.
That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. I was just going to do an ad for the dictator that we're promoting from a former Soviet republic. Where do you think? I mean, there was when I started, it was David Broder. David Broder was sort of and I don't even know if that name means anything to you, but David Broder was the Washington Post sort of like the dean. I think they referred to him as the dean of Washington Beltway journalists. Now, everything has become so much less aggregated and so much more diffuse, and not just from, you know, because of online publications, but because of social media, that there isn't the idea of a person being. But when you look on the landscape, is like, are the Times and the Post still sort of the institutions that that are the ballast for this? I mean, where, like, is there? That's the question.
Yeah. I mean, I think television news is the worst. I think Shep Todd is a really malevolent actor here. The Times and the Post, they have their journalistic norms, which inherently obfuscate truths that the GOP has an interest in obfuscating. But they also do a lot of really great reporting that does, expose Republican lies and in the Trump era, everything is the corruption, the bad faith is so transparent that you know, more than ever before, objective reality has this liberal bias, and the response of institutions like Meet the Press, at least according to one Media Matters report that I recently looked at, has been to say, well, you know, the objective facts are so anti-Republican that we're going to have a panel where we're going to have an objective reporter, but that means that's basically a liberal, and so then we need two conservatives to sort of balance that out. So you have these panels that are heavily Republican, and not just heavily Republican, but Eric Erickson is a respectable conservative who can come on Meet the Press and talk, like the guy who wants to throw leftists from helicopters into the sea. I mean, if you imagine what the left-wing equivalent of that would be, it would be some kind of Maoist tanky or something.
Right.
You can't really imagine that Chuck Todd is going to have on. I don't know. I think that I don't know how influential those institutions are anymore is the potentially good news. I don't really know that the audience for Meet the Press is really getting that much of their understanding of politics from that show.
Right.
But to the extent that it is, it's not good.
There must be some weird data about that because Meet the Press has had that problem. I mean, you know, we can say now objective reality is considered left. So we have a non-biased reporter on and they're supposedly the liberal or the left voice. But whatever the scenario was 10 years ago or 8 years ago or 15 years ago, exact same makeup of a panel. Exact same makeup. I mean, I think it was, you know, I think the joke still is if it's Sunday, it must mean a Republican, you know, the panel's all Republican, essentially.
Or just five John McCain's, just a clone of him.
Exactly. I mean, now that John McCain is gone, it's opened the door and Eric Erickson walks through, I guess. But, I mean, it would be interesting to see if there has ever been a sort of an assessment of what exactly cable news now does in terms of like public opinion. And obviously it goes through, right? Like, because when we say public opinion, I mean, it seems to me these narratives are fought like there's like 15-20% of the turf is where the battle is fought over, right? Like there's like, you know, and then the idea is that if you can win the majority of that 20% of the turf of our, you know, sort of societal landscape, then the other 80% will more or less come along, right? That's the theory here, right? Like, I mean, I'm just trying to think of like why I do this every day. and you know, if we can move, you know, 0.5%, 0.05% of the broader population, you know, if we have, I don't know, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 people that we can convince of a certain narrative, but the idea is that it implicates that you know, most of those people are on Twitter, and the only people who talk politics on Twitter are, you know, listeners of a daily podcast, and then media, you know, political media, that it shapes their coverage, and then this sort of diffuses out to the general public. I mean, do you have a theory about that?
Yeah, well, I think that Fox News is incredibly effective because it you don't need to opt into Fox News necessarily to get brainwashed by it, as these studies have shown, you know, that in places where Fox News is added, and I think like it's a fairly low channel number, so people just happen to click on it more, that you see this shift towards Republicans where, you know, people who weren't necessarily all that conservative, suddenly their source of news is reshaping their minds, and it's presented as fair and balanced or whatever, and they don't necessarily internalize the partisan bend of it. But I think that across the board, what these media outlets, I think, like Fox News and you know, obviously in a much more limited way, the Majority Report, I think are probably most effective in building out the ideological consensus or views within the partisan tribe that you know, that Fox News has turned a lot of right-leaning Americans into, you know, just nativist, paranoid, proto-fascists. And I think that institutions like the Majority Report and like left-wing media, I think, potentially give partisan Democrats a more sophisticated understanding of what progressive politics is about and what they should be on the lookout in terms of policing the direction within their party. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have access to data to determine how much, you know, progressive media is making a difference with that, you know, whatever small chunk of largely white, non-evangelical Midwestern voters who aren't firmly in one partisan camp or another, what is reaching them. I do think I've written about this before, that there is this problem for Democrats where Fox News, you can have such a coherent mass.
It's the cable coherence. Network. It's the coherence.
It's the coherence, yeah. And they can demonize immigrants without really pissing off their shareholders all that much. Whereas Democrats, what you would be wanting to do with, if you had a propaganda apparatus that was similar, would be to build out the class identity of the viewership, yeah. And you would need to demonize oligarchs all day, every day. And that's just not really a viable prospect for a for-profit cable news company.
That's certainly, you know, there were moments during Air America's tenure where that was a bit of a problem, where the populism would run up against, you know, the potential to, like, how are you going to sell this to Democracy Alliance? Which, incidentally, we never got a dollar from the Democracy Alliance, and I'm not convinced. And I think part of that was also just, like, radio in and of itself, aside from the message, the medium itself is highly populist. And so the tenor and the tone of it,
yeah.
And so if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is that the jury's still out as to whether I am completely wasting my life.
I would say so, yes.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Eric Levitz, thank you so much for your time today. We got a link up to your up to that piece. GOP is making its contempt for democracy clear. Will the mainstream media? As well as your next piece, conservatives are right to write off big cities. Eric, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. So there it is, folks. Our look at your media today. I do think things have gotten better. And I think things have gotten better for, in part because audiences have gotten smaller, less aggregated. The because of Twitter. And people have to remember that in 2003, there was no mechanism. The only mechanism I recall, I mean, Atreos had his blog. Josh Marshall had his. Daily Kos was up there. Liberal Oasis, Bill Scherz. There was one with Stoller and Jerome Armstrong. I can't remember what it is now. And Chris. But, you know, and Digby at one point. But there was and Steve Gillard. There were, you know, a couple of dozen blogs. The biggest media critic at the time, the earliest one, was a guy, the Daily Howler. And you can go back and look at the writing is actually worth going back. I think it's the Daily Howler. Bob, I can't remember his name now. But there were no institutions on the left that were critiquing media in any way. There was no one who was quantifying, like, hey, it was all just like, it seems like, you know, like, you never, nobody, you know, in the late 90s, it didn't necessarily occur to many people, like, hey, how come everybody on TV is a Republican?
This makes me think about how, like, the NBA, they didn't realize how valuable three-pointers were in, like, the 90s, so they weren't shooting enough of them. Like,
yeah.
Analytics comes around, and then you're like, wait a second, we've been fucking this up for a long time.
Well, there was also, you know, that happened with the Billboard charts. When they started to put in measures of actual sales in stores all across the country, music stores. This is how you used to buy your music, Matt. you would go to a store and buy what was known as a record. And
I just downloaded it illegally.
No, but you couldn't download at that time. There was no internet.
Oh.
Yeah. And so when they computerized the stores, like actually could assess to combine the data, as opposed to just like checking out the top five, you know, tower records in the country or whatever it was for the Billboard charts, they found out like, oh my God, Phil Collins is not that popular. It's rap. And
who would have thought?
Yeah, like overnight, the entire music business changed because the illusion that they had been selling was wrong. We didn't have anything quite as dramatic when it came to cable news or TV news, but the opportunity for people, you know, to address other people on Twitter and whatnot.
You saying that communist newspapers like Socialist Worker did not have a wide reach in the population?
Not then, but now much much wider.
Maybe slightly wider.
Slightly wider. And speaking of Twitter, so let's talk about this before we go into the fun half. This guy now has been filling up my my Twitter thing, and I think he responded, and I sort of feel bad for him a little bit. This guy, Brandon Straka, he's the unsilent minority.
Off to a good start.
Off to a good start. And he was responding to a tweet that I did to Dave Rubin. Dave Rubin was talking about how there's a revolt against Patreon, I guess, because Sargon of Akkad got bumped from it or something. I'm not sure. To be honest with you, I haven't followed it.
Yeah, they might be getting nervous.
And
if I shared a platform with Stephen Molyneux on Race and IQ, I might be worried about my Patreon too.
Yeah, exactly. And so so Dave Rubin you know, posted another thing. Like the guy lives in an alternate universe where what's going on like with him is really what's going on with everybody, because everybody has that experience of living in Hollywood and having a YouTube studio in your basement, okay? And that is funded by the Koch brothers. And so he put out the revolt against Patreon is real. Can you pull up the Rubin? Yeah, you go. Yeah, you got to go back there. Yeah, the revolt against Patreon is real. I'm weighing my options, but for those of you who want an alternative way to support, you can go directly to daverubin.com/donate. Oh, we probably shouldn't say that. We don't want to push too many people there.
Yeah, don't go there, listeners.
And so I wrote back, is this as real as walk away or even really realer? Because he, like, if you go back, I don't know, people can find it. And if you find it, send it to me. I would love to see it. Like in September and in August or before he took his break in like June, he's like, something really real is happening. Things are changing. I can feel the ground shifting below my feet. Walk away is going to be huge. And then he bagged out of the walk away march. And how many people, we saw the walk away thing, right? Didn't we see a video of it? There was almost like a couple hundred people who had amassed. It was like the million man march, but minus like a million men. And
yeah, it was more of a mosey, if I recall.
Right. And then we saw this dude, what's his name? Brandon Straka. He is a, I think he's a model. Actor model.
He's trying so hard to be the new Milo, and he just doesn't have it.
He doesn't have it. But he apparently, after we had talked about how hilarious his thing was, and like I say, he's a performer, so maybe he meant it to be funny. He wants to come on the show, and apparently he IM'd me, or not IM'd, tweeted me last night. Hey, Sam Cedar, I told that SJW girl on your show. I'd love to come on your show or have you come on mine so you could say the things to my face that you say about me and walk away when I'm not there, like the sniveling weasel you are. She declined. Care to confront me to my face? Sure. If you're inviting me on your show, I'll be happy to go.
Oh, dude, his show is so bad.
I'll go on a show. And then he went, somebody said, so many walked away, and yet the Dems had the largest margin of victory in history. And he wrote, delusional? It was one of the most underwhelming midterm election results for an opposition party in decades. Trump did better than Obama, Clinton, and Reagan. Now, well, we know the game he's playing here, but I guess we could talk about that on...
what's his show called?
On his show. I would imagine it's called The Unsilent Majority.
I have a pretty good clip that I just forwarded to Matt.
And he, someone said, they offered you to call their daily live show any day and make sure you get through. You keep crying about not getting some kind of special treatment. And he said, a phone call is cowardly. And,
yeah, he wanted a video call, which we don't really do on this show.
Well, we've never done. But with that said, we're going to try and set one up for tomorrow. We have an interview. We have a sort of a debate with a libertarian, Adam Kokesh. This is tomorrow. And so, this is his, let's watch his, you got Laura Loomer on.
Yeah, okay. I found a pretty good representative clip from
let's
his
look
show.
At
what minority is Straka?
What minority?
Group, what minority group is he a part of?
Why is he a, because he's the unsilent minority?
Yeah.
I guess.
He is the minority is the former liberal?
I guess it's the opposite of the silent majority?
It's the opposite of the silent majority.
The other thing that I was reading, this was I found this on BuzzFeed because I wanted to see how they were describing your Twitter ban. And this one is just utterly delicious. And I want to actually, it's kind of funny, but I want to get into it because I want to actually dispel some of the theories or some of the statements that they have out there, leftists have out there about you. And then we'll actually get into the tweet. According
already,
to BuzzFeed, you're a far-right personality known for spreading hoaxes and false conspiracy theories. The suspension comes after Loomer tweeted a series of anti-Muslim falsehoods about Ilhan Omar, a Somali refugee who is one of two Muslim women elected to Congress. Okay, this is something that I read about you a lot, Laura, and I want to ask you about it. Are you anti-Muslim?
I'm anti-Islam.
You're anti-Islam.
Yes.
Okay.
There you go. The liberal media lying again. Hilarious.
Thank God that minority is being unsilent now.
Wow. Oh, so I get it now. We're the people who just verify everything that the left-wing media says. Wow. All right.
Yeah,
well,
Sean and I watched that about five times.
Oh, my God.
Last night.
That is really good. That is really good. Oh, but they said you are anti-Muslim and you're anti-Islam.
We keep lying about Laura Loomer.
Right. Okay. Well, so I guess we'll get in touch with this guy, and I'm happy to go on his show. He can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. In fact, you can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com with your hopes, your concerns, your desires, your best ofs, suggestions. We need some best of suggestions, folks, because we don't want to have to go through all the stuff for our end of the year stuff. So, all right, going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. Boy, did we give you extra content today. I can't even believe it. Just a reminder, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. I think for a couple more days, you can get 30% off your coffee without a coupon code. So it gives you a great opportunity to try Just Coffee if you've never tried it before and you've always been like, I don't want to try it. I don't want to risk not liking the coffee. 30% off, man. It's almost like giving it to you for free. All right, take it easy, Brendan. I'll do my best. Jesus. Don't forget, if you want to come see the live Majority Report, you got to hurry. Ask the moms. And TMBS is happening tonight, I think, unless Michael's going to have a miraculous recovery.
It's going to be from an iron lung.
Yeah. Matt Taibbi will be be in studio, and Michael will probably call in from a plastic bubble. It'll be like that John Travolta thing. I think he'll have the uniform, right, with the whole plastic bubble and the respirator on the back.
I think I saw the remake of that. Bubble Boy. What was Bubble Boy? Who was in that? Was that Chris Kattan? Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh.
That's a bad movie.
Well, the Travolta one was much better. Jamie, on the Antifada?
Out now on the Antifada. Sean and I went to Mexico. We met the Zapatistas. It was really cool. We talk about it. And out tomorrow, we speak with Justin Akers Chacon, author of Radicals in the Barrio, Magonistas, Socialists, Wobblies, and Communists in the Mexican-American Working Class, about how the criminalization of migration has only ever hurt the working class in the U.S. and around the world and benefits the capitalist class, how immigrants from Mexico and elsewhere have breathed life into the labor movement here in the U.S., and we kind of take apart the faux populist arguments that we can fix the problems of globalization by restricting the flow of human labor, whether those arguments are coming from obvious bad faith actors like Tucker Carlson or fake friends like Angela Nagel.
Hmm. So let's get that in when Michael's not here. Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. We talk about Democracy in Chains and why academic libertarians keep winding up in the circles of fascists.
Ooh. You know, they sometimes you get invited to the same parties and you
conferences.
Total coincidence.
I watched your debate with Stefan Molyneux last night, actually.
That was years ago.
Yeah. It's amazing to see his progression from this, like, ostensible, good faith, libertarian, whatever, whatever, to, like, full-on white nationalist.
Yeah. Follow the money.
I don't think I've watched that.
How was it? I think it was pretty good.
Yeah.
It was done, I can't remember, it was some type of, like, outfit, like, pop somebody. We didn't even have live video at that time. I don't think.
Where were you broadcasting from?
The really crappy office that we had in the Dollar Pizza district, we used to call it.
Respect. It was very DIY.
Oh, yeah. It was extremely DIY. This whole place is DIY.
Polished DIY.
Yeah, know. Exactly. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.